This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Chris Estrada quit his day job a few years ago. He was working in a warehouse in Los Angeles, the town where he was born and raised. He'd been doing stand-up at clubs for a little while. He even got a spot on a Comedy Central showcase. He kept working at the warehouse when that set aired. He kept working at the warehouse when he started getting calls from Fred Armisen, who was interested in developing a TV show with him. He'd take meetings during his lunch break, wearing a sweaty back brace. He even kept working at the warehouse after he sold the show to Hulu. Because, he says, well, the pandemic had just started, and why give up a stable gig? So he took a few months to, you know, make sure show business was real. That show is why he came on Bullseye last year. It's called This Fool. Its second season kicks off next week. You can watch it on Hulu. You should, because it's great. It is both deeply regular and deeply weird. It's surprisingly sweet and super funny. Chris Estrada co-created the show. He's also the star. His character Julio lives in South Central LA, where Chris grew up. He wears punk band t-shirts, Levi's, and Chuck Taylors, just as Chris does. But Julio doesn't have a warehouse job, and he doesn't want to get into show business. He works at a nonprofit that helps former gang members adjust to life on the outside. And that's perfect, because Julio's cousin, Luis, is a little bit maladjusted. Luis has just finished up some time in prison, and, well, things have changed since he went in. A lot of his friends are dead or in jail or have just moved on. All of his comedy references are sort of frozen in the late 90s. Like, there is a lot of Austin Powers talk in This Fool. Before we get into my interview with Chris, let's hear a clip from the show. This is from the pilot. Julio is picking up Luis from prison. He's late, and he doesn't have his car.
Where's your ride at, primo?
I let my homegirl borrow it. But don't worry, I got you. I'll call us an Uber.
Uber is like the taxi of the future.
Uber is like the taxi of the future. I know what Uber is.
Damn, talking to me like that. Actually, they have Uber in prison. Yeah. His name is Thumper. And if you give him a pack of cigarettes, he'll carry you around. Like, it's pretty convenient. Yeah. Damn, my boy. I haven't seen you forever. Hey, for real though, why does your body still look 19, but your face looks 56, fool?
Yep.
You got Edward James Olmos face.
Chris, welcome to Bullseye. I'm happy to have you on the show. Your show's super good.
Oh, thanks, Jesse. That really means a lot.
Are you wearing this Love and Rockets t-shirt that you wore in the show?
Yeah, I am. I am. Big Love and Rockets fan. And I wanted to wear shirts that I wear in real life on the show.
That's like a classic Latino nerd text. Like, you could hardly go more classic than that.
Yep. Yeah, that was totally the aim. I go, a lot of people might not know what it is, but for those that do, it'll mean something.
Was there a comic book store in your neighborhood when you were a kid?
Yeah, there actually was. When I was growing up, there was a comic book store on West Boulevard, on the corner of West Boulevard and Hyde Park. It's the border between Inglewood and South Central Los Angeles. And it was a comic book called the CBC, the Comic Book Club. This older black dude named Earl used to own it. And that's where I would go get comic books. And one time I was there with my friend Hector. We were like in elementary school, and I got held up at gunpoint.
That's messed up.
Yeah. Just some hood comic book story.
I was present for a couple of things like that when I was that age. And it just never stopped. Like, when I think about it right now, I'm still kind of terrified.
Yeah. It was such a such a crazy situation. I think we were probably in like sixth grade or something. We were there like looking at comic books, buying some guy comes in and holds the store up at gunpoint. And, you know, I mean, being from where I grew up, it's not that you've seen things like that before. And so it still freaks you out, though. And we were kids. But yeah, I can now really laugh at it because I think the guy went in there and he went in there to rob the place for money. But I think he put two and two together and he saw that these comic books that are pinned to the wall are valuable. So it was just really funny to hear some dude be like, give me that Incredible Hulk.
He's like picking them out.
Yeah, picking them out.
Give me that one.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm not really a DC guy, so
yeah.
Let's.
Yeah, he's like, I'm a Vertigo guy. Give me that Vertigo.
He's only into art comics.
Yeah.
It's like, this is
for
grown-ups. I'm not into that.
I'm a grown dude.
The comic book store guy by my house when I was a kid, shout out to Al from Al's Comics. He was like a classic comic book store dude. I mean, God bless him, you know. He was across the street from the Boys and Girls Club, so, you know, he dealt with doofuses all, you know, doofy 12-year-olds all day long. So, you know, and he was always gracious about it to the extent he was capable.
That's great.
But like now you go into a comic book store, you know, it's like some like 20-year-old women with mermaid hair and gauges and whatnot. And like Al was just like a guy in a dirty t-shirt with a ponytail who was a little mad you were there.
Yeah, that's how it was for me. Now it feels like it's a little counterculture-ish, you know, or like, you know, that kind of comic book culture is pretty mainstream or alternative mainstream, I guess, or whatnot. But, you know, back then it was like older dudes who were like, I just love this and this is the business I run and I'm kind of a
You have a bit in your stand-up act about holding the world record for most times losing a fight.
Yeah, that kind of came from, I always talk about how in the bit I talk about, like, I'm not a physical fighter, I'm an emotional fighter, and that, like, I don't win fights physically, I win them mentally. So the idea is that kind of like, if I may get my kicked, but when the guy's walking away, I'm going to say that that's why his little brother makes more money than him. And his wife's incredibly unhappy in their marriage or whatever. You know, just that idea of just like, I feel like I've always been kind of a smart in that sense. And like, you know, I just like that idea of like, yeah, you might have, you know, messed me up or whatever, but I'm going to say something really cutting to you that's going to hurt your feelings. And that's even worse because you clearly don't have respect for me, but I said something so cutting to you that it's going to stay with you.
How many times have you IRL gotten yourself beat up?
You know, I feel like, truthfully, it's not even that many. It's just that the idea is that when I did get into fights, I was like, yeah, we'll fight, but I'm also going to say something very mean to you. Yeah.
One time a dude just punched me walking down the street, but that's the only time I ever, like, I'll run. I'll book it so fast, so... But a dude just walking opposite directions, he was wearing the same jacket as me, pissed him off, he punched me.
See, my problem is that I'll stay there and fight, knowing I might lose. I have just this pride thing of like, I'd rather put up a fight, know that I'm probably going to get my ass, but I'm going to say something to you, you know? Like, I'm still going to call you a loser, like even though I lost.
In the bit, it's your girlfriend says to you, that's why your mom is going bald.
Yeah, in the bit, I say that I always say my fighting technique is similar to that of an angry girlfriend in an argument. I just win the fight by saying the most messed up thing that had nothing to do with the argument whatsoever. And that's the example. I go, one time I was arguing with my girlfriend and she said, that's why your mom's going bald. And we were arguing about rent money. Like, what did my poor mother's balding scalp have to do with any of this? You know, so just kind of taking that technique of like, yeah, that's where I'm going to go. I'm learning from them.
I've seen you describing your character on the show as dealing with an existential crisis. It borders on nihilism. I mean, there's a scene in the pilot where he goes up to some dudes he's been scared of that are camped out in front of his house.
Yeah,
kind of, you know, talk down to him. And he basically asks them to kill him.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what it is? I think it's also like to just have an existential guy in a working class world, because they exist, you know, and they exist. And it was just really inspired by, like, there's this movie called Killer of Sheep, a whole movie about this black family in Watts in like the late 1970s. And the husband of that family is kind of going through an existential crisis. He works at a meat factory, like a sheep factory or whatever, where they kill sheep. And there's just something so funny. He's trying to describe his depression to his friend one time. He's telling his friend like how he feels, how life feels existential to him. And the only response his friend has who doesn't get what he's talking to, he goes, well, if you're so sad, why don't you kill yourself? it killed me. And it just kills me to, yeah, I don't think existentialism is sort of unique, like, in that world. I think you'll find people who are existential in any class bracket or race or ethnic group, but you'll find them. But what you'll find is that people around them usually don't understand what they're going through.
It would be easy for you to make your character Julio a saint.
Yeah.
He works at a rehab place for reforming criminals, and he's the nerd in the hood and all this stuff, right? He's kind of a narcissist. Was a choice?
That was a big choice, yeah. Because I wasn't interested in a good guy in that traditional sense or whatever, where people are looking at him like, I was not interested in making the Ted Lasso of South Central Los Angeles. Like, that's fine if you like that, but that was not anything I was interested in, the sweetness. I was interested in, like, looking at, like, codependency. And what is the nature of helping someone? And oftentimes in codependency, when you're helping someone, it's not based in altruism. Like, it's to run away from your own problems. And you're kind of patting yourself on the back while doing so, because you feel so awful about yourself. You have to convince yourself that you're a good guy, and you got to tell other people you're a good guy.
What did your parents do for work?
My mom was a janitor, you know, blue collar job. She's an immigrant from Mexico, single mom. My dad, he was a bartender for many years at an El Torito in Marina del Rey. That's still there. And then after that, he worked as a busboy. He worked in construction. You know, immigrant parents, they didn't have formal education, so they worked blue-collar, working-class jobs.
Did they expect you to go to college or no?
I think they wanted me to go, but I went. I went to Cal State Northridge. I failed. My freshman year, I didn't come back. And I just, you know, it was mostly my mom. And I think she was just kind of like, well, I hope you figure something out. And I didn't figure out something for quite a long time. I was working like a lot of menial jobs. Up until I started comedy, I had several jobs throughout the years.
More with Chris Estrada after the break. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Vuori. Jump into a new perspective on performance apparel. Vuori makes products that stand the test of time and hope to inspire others to live vibrant, healthy lives, empowering your best life in clothing that can be worn for just about any activity, from running to yoga. Visit Vuori.com/NPR to receive 20% off your first purchase and enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75. Discover the versatility of Vuori clothing.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, my guest is Chris Estrada. Chris is the creator and star of This Fool, a new TV comedy streaming now on Hulu. On the show, Chris plays Julio, a 30-something guy who lives in South Central with his family. He stars opposite Frankie Quinones, who plays Luis, an ex-con and Julio's cousin. This Fool's second season kicks off later this month. Let's get back into our conversation. A lot of people start doing stand-up when they're like 19.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot of successful comics who started later on in life. My buddy Al Madrigal was like 27 or 28, something like
that. That's right.
Yep. You were even older than that, right? You were like 28 or 29.
I was 29. I was 29 when I started.
What made you think you could do it?
You know, because I didn't think about it in terms of like, I'm going to make a career out of this. Because I think that would have, I think I had probably burned a lot of bridges by that time with friends or, you know, ex-girlfriends or what. I was just kind of like, what am I doing? And I think I had been let go of a job at that point. And I always say I was one of those dudes that, like, before stand-up, my personality was dude with three jobs. Like, I would just go from work a morning job. I had to work three jobs to get paid like I was having a decent full-time job. And I was doing that. But then I just remember my nights started getting free. And I always wanted to do stand-up. In the last few years of, like, in my mid-20s, I really got into stand-up. I always enjoyed it, but I really got into it. And, you know, I loved hearing stand-up. I loved stand-up albums. I also wanted to write. Like, I liked screenwriting. I didn't know how to do it or anything, but I liked it. And I loved movies. I was really into movies. I loved the Coen brothers. You know, I was watching things like Killer of Sheep and, you know, watching tons of movies. And, you know, what's so funny? I remember at 25 telling this woman I was dating at the time, like, I want to start stand-up. And she goes, that's embarrassing. And I go, you're right. And then I waited 4 years. And then finally, when I started, I think I just said, I just want to try it. I think if I thought about it in the long haul, it would have overwhelmed me. I think when I started stand-up, I had incremental goals. And having big goals would have really consumed me or freaked me out. But I was just like, oh, I want to try it. I want to see if I can get on stage and say these jokes that I wrote. And then it went okay the first time. It didn't go awful. It didn't go great either, just okay. And then I said, that's enough for me to keep going. And then I kept going, and, you know, then things, I would have really bad sets. But then once I was like, once I knew I had a bad set and I wanted to keep doing it, I said, all right, there's something here if I want to keep doing this. But yeah, I started at 29, and it was pretty intimidating because most people were actually younger. Like, everybody who I was meeting at the time was like 19, 20, 21, 22. And, like, you know, I kind of came from this, like, I thought I knew something because I was older, even though I had real no accomplishments. Like, I just thought I've lived a life or whatever. I should know something. But I knew that that didn't translate into the craft of being funny. Like, I think I knew I was inherently funny, or, like, I had funny thoughts. But, you know, it's a craft. And I was like, it was really humbling to, like, be 29 and I bomb, but then some 19-year-old goes up on stage and does great.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
There's a great moment in your act when you start talking about bits that work at your job.
Yeah.
That you couldn't bring on stage.
Yeah. I always say that, like, I'm considered a comedic genius at my old warehouse job. And then I, you know, it's just the idea of that, like, I may not be, I don't know what you're going to think about me here, but I will tell you this. There's a warehouse I used to work at, and everybody thinks I'm a comedic genius. And it's just the idea of differentiating, because I kind of wanted to find a way of, like, how can I talk about these things I'm living? Or, yeah, I was working at a warehouse at the time, and while I was still doing stand-up, and I was just like, it just made me laugh, the humor of what was funny at work. Like, you know, so much of what's funny at work only works at work.
You know, as a comedian, you work really hard to be smart, funny, and clever. But what's great about being funny at my warehouse job is you don't have to be any of those things. And I know that because a few weeks ago, I saw my coworker Armando. He was covered in sweat from unloading trucks all day. And I walked up to him and I said, damn, fool, you look cold. Put a sweater on. And they've been laughing about that for 2 weeks now. Oh, they can't get enough of it. They can't get enough of it. The other day, Jose came up to me. He was like, hey, fool, what was that joke you told Armando a few weeks ago? I go, well, check this out. He was covered in sweat, right? So I told him that he looked cold and he should put a sweater on. And Jose said, how do you come up with this? You should be a comedian.
You know, so just the idea of that, I can really crack these guys up with, like, softball pitches of the worst type of job humor. But it just wouldn't work anywhere else. And the thing is, when they find out that you're funny or that you're doing stand-up, they go, do the stuff you do here at work, you know? Like, I used to go up to some of my coworkers at this warehouse and I used to say, hey, don't tell anyone, but I'm with Undercover Boss. I actually own this warehouse. Like, we're filming something, like, you know, and it would kill them. But I go, I can't. They would do that on stage when you do stand-up. I go, it doesn't work, guys. Like, believe me.
What was the comedy that you got really into when you were in your 20s?
You know, comedians like Greg Giraldo, who passed away. He was a really smart comedian that I just thought, like, so sharp and funny, wrote really funny jokes. Just felt like him and comics like Colin Quinn, Patrice O'Neill, even comics like Maria Bamford that I really enjoyed. I think I was listening to, like, Mitch Hedberg or T.O. Hughley, I really liked at the time. But I remember it was really Greg Giraldo that I just thought, this guy's, like, not underestimating the audience. I just like when you can make a mechanic working class guy laugh, but also make some pretentious snob laugh at the same time. I really enjoy that because I don't think you're underestimating anyone. And I thought, like, comics like Greg Giraldo were doing that. Like, it was really great to see. Like, he would have just really great jokes, really smart jokes. Like, yeah, he was one of those kind of, like, I wouldn't say he was necessarily political, but, you know, he was kind of topical, but had interesting takes on things. But also the same thing, like, I just remember being like, I remember listening to, like, someone like Maria Bamford and it just killing me and thinking, well, there's something to this because I'm a dude who's working regular jobs and, you know, I'm from LA. I'm not from where Maria Bamford's from, where her humor informed her from. Like, I think she's from Minneapolis or that area, maybe Wisconsin or something.
Duluth, I think she's from.
Yeah, maybe. Duluth, yeah. But I just remember thinking, well, she found a way to make that funny. And, you know, I think we probably have lived different lives and it's still making me laugh. So I just always loved somebody that was like, yeah, those kind of comics really informed me a lot.
This Fool is set in South LA.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot more depictions of Latino culture in LA that are set in East LA.
Yeah, that's right.
Why did you want to set it in South LA?
Because I grew up there and I was living there at the time. And, you know, I think I have a tremendous amount of respect for East LA and communities like Boyle Heights and whatnot. I think there's a rich history there. And, you know, Latinos, specifically Mexican Americans, have been there for a long time. And, you know, activism and movements have come out of there. But that wasn't my life. You know, I didn't grow up there. You know, it's kind of a homogenous neighborhood. Like, you know, it's 90-something percent Latino. And I grew up in Inglewood. And then as an adult, I lived in South Central Los Angeles. So they're right next to each other. And like, I had family and, you know, I had an uncle that lived in Compton. I had family that lived in South Central. I had family that lived in Inglewood. Like, so, yeah, that's what I knew. And that's where my life was at. And I also, like, you know, I wanted to have a show that, like, you know, most of these shows, when it's about Latinos, it's usually set in East LA. But I just wanted to have a show where the neighbors are Black, because my neighbors were Black, you know? Or I wanted a show that sometimes they get along and sometimes they don't, you know, and being comedically honest about that. Because that's always been my version of LA. Like, up until quarantine, I didn't live anywhere else. Like, I always lived in a part of LA that was both Latino and Black. So that just felt natural to me. And it also felt interesting. Like, you know, sometimes we had great relationships with Black neighbors, or I had great relationships with some of my Black neighbors. But I also went to a high school that had race riots, like, you know, where it was Latinos against Black people. Like, there would be race riots twice a year. Or sometimes gangs in the neighborhood, a Latino gang and a Black gang, might not get along. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And that was kind of like, I don't know, I always just think those relationships are interesting. And I just thought, oh, you never see that. It's always kind of homogenous, you know, and I'd like to see a little bit of that.
One of the things that I like about the slightly scary dudes hanging out outside your house, yeah, racing remote control cars is, first of all, racing remote control cars, just classic activity. Yeah. But also, right, it's two Latino dudes and two black guys. And there's a moment where one of the Latino guys says, last time around, it was blacks versus Mexicans. Now it's Mexicans versus blacks. Mm-hmm. And then his buddy goes, I'm Salvadoran. You know I'm Salvadoran.
Yeah.
I said I'm Salvadoran.
Yeah. Yeah. That was just really like a funny joke to me, but also a way to acknowledge like, yeah, there's a lot of Salvadorans in this city. Like, you know, a lot of my friends are like, I grew up, some of my closest friends are from Central America, you know? So I just thought it was really funny because, you know, sometimes there's such a, I don't know because I'm Mexican American, but I would imagine if you're from Guatemala or El Salvador, you know, Mexican kind of encompasses the culture or whatever. So, you know, it was just funny for me to sort of touch on this, like, black versus Mexican, and the guy being like, hey, dude, we're on the same side. I'm Salvadoran. Like, yeah. Thought it was a really funny moment to do that.
I think when I first moved to LA, I was not used to people calling a Latinos Mexican.
Yeah.
I wasn't even used to people calling Mexican Americans Mexican.
Yeah.
But I think it's a byproduct of, as you said, the kind of hegemony of Mexican American culture in LA is like almost nowhere else in the United States.
Yeah, that's right. I think there's a lot of that. I mean, because it's a lot of us here. But, you know, growing up where I grew up, there was a lot of Salvadoran kids around or Guatemalan kids. So it was like, in a way, we kind of grew up like, I always kind of say this in a way, I didn't grow up viewing myself as a Chicano, you know, because my parents were immigrants. And, you know, they didn't have formal education. So they didn't have, you know, that's a term that was, I think, invented here and, you know, was sort of like came through like counterculture and civil rights and politics and whatnot. So, you know, my parents were immigrants and they came out here and they had like blue collar jobs. So to them, they were just like, you're Mexican, you know, and then I sort of just viewed myself that way. And then as I got older and my friends were other things, like other types of Latino, this term just Latino took over, you know? And I was like, yeah, I'm just Latino dude from LA, you know? Now that I'm older, I understand the context of what being a Chicano is. And I have an understanding of like, yeah, I guess I am that, but I didn't grow up with it. It wasn't prevalent in my life, you know? I even tell people like, you know, when I was growing up, my mom didn't even know what that meant. Like, my mom thought that meant gangsters with lowriders. Like, you know. So,
she was
confused
between Chicanos and Cholos.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They both start with
Yeah, yeah. You know, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, another thing about LA Latino culture is remains a city of immigrants, right? There are many first and second generation Americans in Los Angeles from all over the world, but certainly from Mexico and Central America.
Yeah.
There's also a huge community of Mexican Americans in LA whose families have been in LA for six generations, eight generations. And in, you know, there are certainly people who have ancestors who have been in California since before California was part of the United States.
Yeah. That trips me out because that wasn't I never knew anyone like that. I think, you know, where I grew up, and where I lived as an adult, everybody was kind of, their parents got here in the late 70s and 80s. Like, you know, to me, the idea of somebody's parents speaking English, and if they were Latino, I'd be like, yo, that's insane, you know? Like, or I remember one time I met this girl from East LA, or she was like from Boyle Heights, and she told me that her grandfather fought in World War II. And I said, what? Like, I was like, he's been here since then? It just blew my mind.
I had a conversation with Al Madrigal one time, stand-up comic, he's half Mexican-American, half Italian-American. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't speak any Spanish at all, I don't think.
Yeah.
Or his Spanish is terrible, one or the other.
Yeah.
And, like, he's been in a lot of situations in comedy where there is an expectation that he is either going to be like an intensely Mexican-American comedian or he's going to be like a righteous Chicano comedian. He's not either of those things at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And like he has to figure out how to deal with that, right? Like when you're a comic, you have to deal with whatever assumptions people make about you right away or you're never going to get anywhere on stage.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I feel sort of similar in a sense. I mean, like, I speak fluent Spanish because I just grew up speaking it. Like, my mom didn't speak English, you know? So I never feel that I'm not enough of anything. I just know what I am. Like, this is what I'm into. This is my point of view. I'm not going to come up here and give you cultural jokes that you've heard before. You know, I got a point of view on things, or I have these esoteric thoughts that I think I can make funny. And yeah, so sometimes it takes a minute for them to be like, get a context for you, you know?
Your character on the show wears a lot of punk rock t-shirts in addition yeah. to your comic book t-shirt there.
Yeah.
Are you a punk rock guy?
Yeah. I mean, I love it. It really had a profound effect on me. I wanted the show to have a little, have that, you know, because I always tell people, like, you know, this is not unique. This guy is not unique. There's more dudes like me in these neighborhoods, in these working class neighborhoods, than there is gang members, you know? Like, what's going to make the rounds in the news is the sensationalism of gangs or whatever. But the character of Julio or me as a person, we're not, I grew up with 20 dudes, men and women who are just like me, you know? So, but I wanted that. I wanted to have that, like, I wanted to wear punk shirts in there because I love that. You know, I think I grew up listening to, like, punk and hardcore, and it still plays a profound effect on my life. Like, I try to sneak little things in there. We had an episode about Ronald Reagan, and I thought to myself, we should close the episode out with an 80s hardcore song that's an anti-Reagan song. So we reached out to the band DOA, and we got the song F'd Up Ronnie, and closed out the episode with that. Because I just thought, like, yeah, if we're doing a Reagan episode, let's have an anti-Reagan anthem by a hardcore band from the 80s. And tried to sneak in stuff. I wore Joe Strummer t-shirts in there, Clash t-shirts in there. Little Easter eggs. There's an episode I have that's like a birthday episode. The whole point is my character hates celebrating his birthday and whatnot. And when he looks at his text, one of the texts he receives is from Joe Strummer that says happy birthday. And I love when people pick up on that. And so I saw that you sneaked that in.
I feel like that's a pretty delicate telephone call calling DOA. Yeah. Like, you can't just send the regular Hulu music clearance lawyer.
No, yeah. you got to send a letter saying, hey, I really love DOA.
like, hi, I'm calling from Celebrity Family Feud.
Yeah.
And
yeah, we were wondering. No, I had to be like, just so you know, your album Hardcore 81 played a big role in my life. like, you got to let them know. But yeah, we were able to just get some music. There was music that we licensed from local Latino punk hardcore bands from the area. We use music by this really great band called Generación Suicida. They're from South Central Los Angeles. We used another song by this really great band called Toscos. They're from Santa Ana, California. And it was really cool. I just remember being like, we should use some of their music. These are bands that I like, you know. And who, when I was, if I wasn't doing stand up, I would go see. And it was really cool to do that.
I'm the least punk rock dude ever, but, you know, I knew punk rock kids growing up, going to arts high school and stuff. And, you know, anytime I've ever had anybody on this show who was that way as an adolescent, like the depth of its effect on their life is so extraordinary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What was it for you?
You know, I think for me, when I was growing up, it was like the things that were around me were kind of like, you know, you could hear hip hop, you know, hip hop was around, but also my parents' music, you know, Mexican music, Latino music was around. But there was just something about punk and its energy and its like anger that really just got to me, that I just thought, this is great, because I already feel different. So this is perfect for that. And then, you know, just like some bands were slightly personal and expressed more emotive thoughts, and some bands expressed more political thoughts or, you know, societal thoughts. And that really intrigued me. Like both, you know, bands like Fugazi to like The Clash and like, you know, there's another band called Los Crudos. I wear one of their t-shirts. They're like a Chicago band. And, you know, that kind of anger really got to me. They were presenting ideas. And I thought that was like really cool. It, you know, it was through like through the Minutemen that I found out about. They had a song called El Salvador, and like, you know, reading about like the Civil War then, it really helped inform me a lot. Or even like The Clash having a band, having an album called Sandinista. I was like, what is that? And then you find out it's like, oh, there was a Nicaraguan rebellion, you know, like rebellion at the time. You start digging deeper, you know, and it was through punk rock that really kind of opened me up.
I mean, it's funny to think about the wars in Nicaragua and Salvador from punk rock as an adolescent, when presumably there was like lots of kids around whose parents had come to the States because of those wars, or in some cases, maybe themselves. I don't know exactly how old you are, but.
Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. I'm 38. And, you know, there was kids who, you know, the thing about it is sometimes they might have not even known why they were here, you know, and their parents probably, you know, there's people who don't understand the depth of why things are started or whatever, you know. So, yeah, that was really interesting. Or like hearing, I just remember hearing like Rage Against the Machine songs and them talking about what was going on in Chiapas at the time.
The other thing about punk rock that like, there's a guy that's not that, I have a hard time wrapping my head around is like the physical part of it. Like the way people talk about going to shows is about first and foremost sense of community I hear from people, but also like a physical experience of.
Yeah. Slam dancing, like people slamming and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, you know, it's so funny. It's something that I don't go to shows anymore. Or like if I do, I'm not interested in doing that. Like I'm 38 and my knees hurt sometimes. But I think when you're young, or even if you're my age or older, like you might have an anger or a frustration or like, you know, that kind of aggressiveness of like slam dancing might work for you. You know, I think when I was young, it was really exciting, like to be like, wow, people slam dance, like this is cool. And you fall, they'll pick you up, and it's aggressive, but it's communal. You know, it was pretty good. I can totally see how it wouldn't make sense to anyone who's not part of that world. I remember explaining it to my older cousin who's like not into that. And he'd be like, so you guys just beat each other? Like, it made no sense to him.
That's how I felt when I was like, what are you? Sorry, say that again.
Yeah. Yeah, so funny.
We'll wrap up with Chris Estrada from This Fool in just a minute. When we come back from the break, we'll talk about creating the character Luis in the show and how he kept an ex-con cousin from coming off as a stereotype. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. The right agent can make or break your home search. That's why Homes.com provides an agent directory that details each agent's experience so you can find the right one and ultimately the right home. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Noom. Noom understands that not everyone is starting from the same place and takes that into account. With their first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, you can find 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hi, I'm Alex Schmidt.
And I'm Katie Golden.
And we make Secretly Incredibly Fascinating, a podcast about why seemingly ordinary stuff is actually the title of the podcast.
Using tons of research, we take a joyful look at history and science and stories.
And jokes.
About the ordinary stuff in your life, because that's what makes those things amazing.
Also jokes.
So get excited about paperclips.
Get thrilled about pigeons.
Get all psyched up and running around the room about the imperial system of weights and measurements.
For real, there's whole episodes about that stuff. Hear them anytime and hear new episodes Mondays at MaximumFun.org.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with comedian Chris Estrada of the TV comedy This Fool. So your character on the show has a counterpart, his cousin, Luis.
Yeah, that's right.
And his cousin, Luis, is fresh out of jail, maybe prison, and living at the house, and they're kind of like pushing on each other.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out
that's
what.
That's right.
How do you write that character? How do you write a 35-year-old semi-retired cholo without being broad, without playing into people's ideas about a, you know, a guy in slides with tube socks pulled up to his knees.
Well, you know, by knowing those guys, like having those guys in my family, like knowing that they're scary to some people, but hilarious to me, or like the kind of guys that can joke with me, that have a, that I know them have a sense of humor. It's like, you know, nobody's that one thing. And like, I mean, I always say this in regular life, that I had cousins who were gang members older than me. And I go, you live in such a dichotomy or such a gray area that you understand, I know they're scary to you, or I know they've done things to maybe people who fear them or now fear them. But I know them in a different facet, in that I know them to be scary, but I also know them to be loving or vulnerable or have insecurities or be guys who are immature, you know, who laugh at things. And I think that's finding a way to sort of like humanize a guy like that, I think is really would make the character unique. And having cousins that were like that, and, you know, I have, basing it off of my real cousins.
How do you cast it?
You know, we went with Frankie Quiñones, who's an amazing actor, amazing comedian, amazing actor. And, you know, in the beginning, we weren't thinking of someone like Frankie. We were thinking of someone more stereotypical, some big buff dude with tattoos all over, you know. And what we found was that oftentimes the jokes, or like us picking on each other, him saying things to me, it didn't feel like a comedy. It felt scary. And when we had Frankie audition, he had this like big kid energy to it, where it's like, he, you know what he brought was a Joe Pesci energy to it. He brought a Joe Pesci energy where it was like, you know, he was loved to make jokes, loved to be funny, but also would kick your ass. You know, he'd be the first guy to get a bat out of the car. He's not the biggest guy in the world. You know, I'm actually taller than him. And like, we then started looking at that image of like me being taller than him, him being shorter. And we just said, that's actually funny. That presents better. Because, you know, the truth of the matter of fact is that also not all gang members are big. Like, not all of them are big. And I started thinking about my cousins who at some point I was actually taller than them. You know, so yeah, that was it. And then Frankie just brought a kind of really just vulnerability to the character. And I think a lot of it was also, you know, with these kind of characters, it's easy to make them Homer Simpson buffoon type characters. And I think it was making sure you write a line where it's like, we want this guy to be funny and immature, but we never want him to feel like he won't kick your ass. And not the character Julio's ass, because they fight each, he doesn't fear him. They get each other in headlocks, but he doesn't fear him because he knows him to be family, and, you know, he knows that he's bigger than them. But you never want him to be too buffoonish or too immature that he's not scared to fight, that you go, this guy won't get a bat out of his car or pull out a gun or something like that. So, you know, it's that thin line.
He also lives very comfortably right on the line between kind of having gone to seed and not. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
Like, your character works in a kind of Homeboy Industries kind of situation, like rehabilitation for convicts and former gang members. And there's just this kind of, one of the big things is this kind of question of, what do you do when you're 40 and you have a face tattoo?
Yeah, absolutely.
And like he really lives very comfortably in that area between going, getting a bat out of his car and coaching youth football.
Yeah. 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 Where it's like, you know, it's hard. It's like, if you've lived that life or whatever, like, I mean, just from growing up, from where I grew up, you have these intentions of your temper will take over, you know? Or sometimes if, whether you're a gang member, you grew up in a working class neighborhood that had gangs, if you don't, you don't have a lot, but you have pride and you have a sense of like, don't mess with me. Or even in my sense, it's like, look, I rather pridefully put up a fight and get my ass kicked than just hand over my money, you know? And I think Luis has that. And I think everybody in that world has that.
Had you quit your job when you sold this show?
No, I worked a few more months. And then I felt like we sold it right before COVID. And then COVID hit. And I remember really thinking to myself, I should go back. Because I think, I don't know that there's going to be TV around anymore. But I will say this. I remember when I thought we were going to be okay, I was on my computer looking at the news, and there was this like entertainment news that said, Disney is developing a live action Tarzan movie. And I thought to myself, if Disney thinks we're going to still have money in 3 years and society hasn't collapsed, they must know something we don't. And then I go, if they're still developing stuff, I'm like, they probably have the vaccine and you're going to have to get it with a proof of purchase that you saw the Tarzan movie.
Just the headline in Variety says Disney hoarding diamonds. Yes. Like, wait a minute.
Wait a minute. They know something. But yeah,
Paramount Prexy has cooking oil.
Yeah. That eventually is what's going to happen, though. But yeah, I did. I quit my job a few months after.
I mean, the good news about warehouse work is it's relatively casual, so you could yeah. get some if you needed it.
Yeah, you could. I mean, I got all those warehouse jobs I had throughout the years were through temp jobs. Yeah, if this doesn't work out in the long haul, I always say I'm going to go back and get my forklift license.
That's where the real money is.
That's where the real money is. Yeah.
Well, Chris, I sure appreciate you taking this time to talk to me, and your show's so great.
Thanks, Jesse. It really means a lot. Thank you so much.
Chris Estrada from last year. The new season of This Fool comes out later this month on Hulu. It is a great show. Chris is great in it. Frankie Quinones is really great in it. Michael Imperioli is in it. The guy from The Sopranos. If you haven't seen This Fool yet, you've got time to catch up on season one, and you should. This is a great show. I love This Fool. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. At my producer Kevin Ferguson's house, he and his neighbor are going to replace the stereo in his car. I support this. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Brianna Paz. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is composed and provided to us by DJW, the great Dan Wally. Our theme song is by The Go Team. It's called Huddle Formation. Thanks to The Go Team. Thanks to their label, Memphis Industries. Bullseye is on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. Find us in those places. Give us a follow. We will share with you all of our interviews. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History. From memes to movements, see how this powerful online community shapes culture and society. Black Twitter, A People's History, is now streaming on Hulu.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. Don't get caught without emergency medical coverage on an international trip. Learn how Allianz Travel Insurance can protect your trip from the unexpected at AllianzTravelInsurance.com.
When voters talk during an election season, we listen. We ask questions, we follow up, and we bring you along to hear what we learned. Get closer to the issues, the people, and your vote at the NPR Elections Hub. Visit npr.org/elections.